Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says the state is dedicating $1.5 million in the state police budget to pay for body cameras. It's the latest in an official attempt to increase accountability and public trust in law enforcement, which is shaky at best these days. Cases of police-related violence against unarmed black citizens has dominated headlines in the last year. The cases of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Eric Garner in Staten Island, and most recently the disturbing unsolved case of Sandra Bland, a 28-year-old black woman found hanging in her Texas jail cell following her arrest over a minor traffic infraction. And that's all ignited heated discussions about policing and racism in America. We have a great expert in the studio today, University at Albany professor Dr. David Bailey. He studied policing, police reform, and criminal justice both in the United States and in countries like India, Australia, Canada, Great Britain, and Singapore. His vitae goes on as long as your arm. He's also a member of the United Nations International Police Advisory Committee and its Global Police Community Advisory Group. Give us a call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Three out of the five phones are already blinking off the hook. It means it's going to go fast, folks. So if you want to get in, get online. We try to move it along as fast as we possibly can. Again, 1-800-348-2551, or write to us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, David, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So basically, what do you study?
I study the police, and I study their police and their relations with the community and what they're doing in order to accomplish what we ask them to do.
Well, that's a pregnant statement, all right. So are we asking them to do things that we are now turning around and saying to them we don't like?
We don't like the way they're doing it. I think we're asking them to do the right thing. We want them to lock up the bad guys. We also want them to act on suspicion and prevent crime to the best of their ability. What we want them to do, however, is do that in a way which agrees with our values and does not alienate the police from the community that they're supposed to be serving.
So when Eric Garner in Staten Island gets put into a police chokehold, right? And we are told that's unorthodox. You're not supposed to do that. How would you fit that into the paradigm you were just discussing?
Well, I think it makes the point. And indeed, Commissioner Bratton said within 24 hours of that event that if what he saw on television was true, it was wrong. So there it is from the top. And this would suggest that the approach that was taken in that particular case, and every case is special in some ways, that in that particular case was a mistake.
Let's go to Kerry in Plainfield, Massachusetts. Kerry, you're on. Oh, hello, Kerry. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Alan.
Kerry.
Yep, I'm here.
I don't think she's there. I think what happened is
I'm here, Alan.
Thinking
Alan.
She was going to be kept on hold for a while, went somewhere else. Alan. Kerry, I'm going to try one more time.
Hello, Alan.
Is he there? Well, I don't
yes,
hear
I
him.
Am.
So something's
Alan.
Not right. Okay, Kerry.
Hello,
Kerry, 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 Kerry,
Alan,
Kerry.
Alan. Hello. Hello.
All right.
Hello, Alan.
I don't know. Well, I'm not hearing them. Maybe somebody in our crack engineering department will come right down and help us out. We'll put him on hold for a little while. And whoops, he's off now. Maybe Kerry can call back. Merle in Argyle, can you hear me, Merle?
Yes. Can you hear me is the question.
Oh, there you are. Merle, are you there?
Yes. I'm Hello. Here.
And,
hello, I'm here.
Hello, can you hear us? Hello,
we can
Merle?
Hear you. I can hear you.
We're having a problem here. I know our cracked engineering department will be down here momentarily to sort of help us out with this. There's got to be a reason that this is not working, and I'm not sure what it is. And I apologize. So, David, I'll ask you another fast question. And by that time, the cracked engineering department will be down here and help us out. Okay. All right. So, David, if you took a poll in the United States and say, are the police being unfair to people of minority status, would you find people are thinking that they are or that they aren't?
They are not. And this goes back 40 years. There's a lot, an avalanche of public opinion on this. White people generally between 75% and 80% agree that they're doing well, and the percentage in the African American community is about 45%. In other words, they're suspicious.
You know, we know that the greatest amount of crime in the United States is black on black crime. The question is that in other words, when we see now people are getting angry, folks of color are getting angry at the way in which they are being treated, is the fact that they're also most subjected to the potential for you know, crime.
Alan, I mean, let me take you up on what you initially said. Most crime that's committed in the United States is committed by white people.
Right.
It's not committed by black on black. It is true, however, that the violence and the killing tends to be black on black. So there's that qualification that I think is really important.
Well, it is important, and I'm glad you corrected me. That's terrific. So the engineering department has arrived, and now we'll try another one. Okay, shall we do that? We'll go to Kerry. We'll go to Kerry we'll go to Kerry, who we last left in Plainfield, Massachusetts. Kerry, are you there?
I'm here. Are you there, Alan?
No, I hear you, but very, very vaguely.
Hello?
So something is not quite right. Okay, now, say again.
Hello?
Oh, there you are. Booming in. You're booming in.
I'm booming in, Alan?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay, man. Thank you so much for bearing with us. Go ahead.
Okay.
What do you have to say?
Over the years, I know policing techniques have changed. And, like, I'm 66 years old, and I can remember once going through any business district in any community or a neighborhood in a large city, and you'd always see beat officers. And that officer probably knew everybody on his beat, and most likely they all know who he was. And, you know, that doesn't seem to be the same today. There's less of a personal connection with the public, I think, the police have.
David? And I'm sorry.
I think that's a widespread perception. I'm not actually sure that there are fewer cops on the beat than there used to be. At the same time, back in the 1980s, this was the community police movement, and there was a big effort to put cops on their feet in communities. And so there is that perception. And in the past 20 or 30 years, American policing has worked away from that. And there is less, I do think it's true, there is less consultation with communities in order to decide to figure out what their priorities are and what they want in their particular areas.
So what do you mean by consultation?
Well, that can take a lot of forms. I mean, there is the form under community policing was to form neighborhood groups that would meet with the local cops and talk to them. And you can organize at various levels, from all the way from the chief on down to the people who are doing the work on their feet.
And what were the most constant complaints?
Oh, you mean of the police themselves?
No, of the councils. In other words, as they spoke with the police, was it that our kids are being stopped too often walking while black, driving while black, or was it that we're not getting enough protection here in our community?
All of that.
Yeah.
I just personally feel that especially your older listeners, and I think they can relate to me, is they miss seeing the police officer on the street, talking to them, and mm-hmm. that personal connection.
Yeah, you know, the downside, let me just say, only on my 1 year working for the New York City Police Commissioner and teaching at John Jay in New York, was that there is a sense that, because at the same time, as David has pointed out, all this was going on, there was another problem, and that it was there was a lot of police corruption. Now, when you put an officer into a community, to some degree, you are asking for people to start giving them a free cup of coffee or this or that, which may lead to other issues. Yes, I mean, that's what the Knapp Commission was all about.
You asking him or me?
Both of you.
Okay. Yes, I think this was a problem. But I think a deeper problem that, and we tend to romanticize the past in terms of policing. In many ways, let me say this at the beginning. In many ways, the behavior of police officers is much better today than it was 40 years ago. And police officers will tell you that they are better supervised and that they must be much more careful in terms of the way they handle people. Back in the 60s and 70s, this was not the case.
Yeah.
So that there has been, I think, a sea change, actually, in the quality of police behavior. At the same time, we're now in a new era. We're in a new era because of handheld cameras, and that all of the defects in behavior of the police are now a matter of public record. And this is going to continue, but and the police must adapt.
But not completely. I mean, in other words, the other day we had one case where the cops stood out of the way of the patrol car camera, knowing full well where it was, and then did his mischief.
Well, I'm not talking about the camera that's in the hands of the police. I'm talking about the citizenry.
Yeah.
And smart chiefs of police now are saying to their people, never assume that you are out of camera range from somebody.
Gotcha. Okay. Hey, listen, Kerry, thank you for the great call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Pirates Lakeside Grill on Nassau Lake, serving local grass-fed beef, Milwaukee hot dogs and sausages, beer-battered fish fry, and handmade milkshakes. PiratesLakesideGrill.com. Habitat Post and Beam, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, designing and manufacturing energy-efficient post and beam homes and additions throughout the Northeast since 1972. PostandBeam.com. Hubbard Hall Center for the Arts and Education in Cambridge, New York, presenting the operas Rigoletto and Old Maid and the Thief in rotating rep August 13th through 23rd, hubbardhall.org. Albany Realty Group, a local woman-owned real estate company since 2003, educating and counseling sellers and buyers throughout the real estate transaction, albanyrealtygroup.com. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. And Siegel Music Colony, Scroon Lake, New York, bringing music to the North Country for 100 years in 2015 with performances and events through August 16th. SiegelColony.org for schedule.
And we are back with our distinguished guest, 1-800-348-2551. So, Dr. David Bailey, the phones are ringing. We want to get everybody in if we can. Let's go and talk to Jim in Albany. All right, Jim, you're on.
Hey, Alan, thanks for the great program.
You're welcome, I'm sure.
And Dr. Bailey, hey, I got a quick question for you. Could you give us a little thumbnail sketch of Prairie View? I believe it's founded right after the Civil War with a very important mission. Would you discuss that briefly? Because I think Sandra just got a job with Prairie View, right?
That is correct. And the answer is I can't fill in what you've asked. All I know is what I read in the paper, and it said that it was for a while a place where freed blacks in the South would come for sanctuary. However, that was a short period of time, and Jim Crow ultimately took over there as well. That's the extent of my knowledge.
So, well, what about Sandra? What about the job she got there? I heard it was a very important job. Is that right?
It was a job at her university from which she graduated. That's correct. What it was, I don't know.
Yeah. You don't know, and you're the expert on the phone?
Come on, Jim. What else? Bring it. What else you got?
Well, I think she. It sounds to me like she had a great job there. She was going to be doing some very important work for the country.
Right.
And that's part of the picture.
Well, you said it, and that's good. That's why you said it.
Right. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very
much. Bye-bye. Yeah. Okay, let's go to Yussel from Coleraine, Mass. Okay, Yussel, you're on.
Hi, Alan. This is Yussel. In the 1960s, I was teaching at Malcolm X Community College in Chicago. And that was the time when Fred Hampton, who was a student at the school, was murdered in his bed by the Chicago police. People have been calling for civilian review boards since before that time, and we still don't have them.
Well, we have them in some places, don't we, David?
Yes, we do, in over 100 cities.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But
so,
let me say this, though. They do vary in their power. Some are very, very powerful and do good work, and others aren't worth it.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of that, Yussel? You think that it's worth it to have strong civilian complaint boards with our police departments?
Yes. I mean, I think that the police need to be in the service of the civilian population, not running amok by themselves. I mean, certainly there are good police here in Coleraine. They're excellent. But one thing that I remember from my time in Chicago, one of my students was a black policeman who was trying to organize a group called the African American Patrolmen's Union, or I forget the exact title. And he said that the number one rule to join the group was to refuse graft. And he said he had a hard time getting people to sign on.
Well, I do remember the Knapp Commission pretty well back in the day, and I do remember at least one expert telling me every time they turned over a rock, there was, because the temptations are so great, they were finding corruption. Now, it was like that old joke about the Vietnam War, we should go home and declare victory. But one wonders whether or not that situation is different, David.
I tell you, I can give you a cynical response, and after Knapp was the Mullen Commission 20 years later, and there are people in New York City who say this is a 20-year phenomenon and we'll get it again. I think that is excessively cynical. Mm-hmm. At the same, because as you pointed out, Alan, the temptations are enormous, and unless there is effective discipline and oversight in the police department, these temptations are there, and there will be people who will exploit them.
But there is this thin concept of the thin blue line, you know. Yeah. I mean, in other words, you take care of your colleagues because people, to quote, don't know how it is out there. They
That's
don't
right.
know how dangerous
That's
it
right.
is. You get in somebody's face and they may be ready to kill you. So there isn't the ability to ask the police turn each other in because they're so close.
That's still very much the case. Yes.
Uh-huh. What do you do about it?
You have to change the values in the police department to make doing that a matter of commendation rather than something that they hide, because they know it's wrong. But let me put it this way. Whether you're in the Marines or whether you're in an occupation in the private sector, whether you're in a university, you tend to protect your own. And you say that people on the outside don't understand what we're doing, and therefore we'll take care of it ourselves. Now, to some extent, internal discipline is the ultimate place where discipline is exerted. And so that's not wholly wrong. At the same time, what we have to do is to say, when people are kind of systemically wrong in these kinds of behavior, what we do as police officers is so important, we can't let it pass. And we must stand together against people like that, so that you change the discipline, so that you isolate those people. Now, that's a cultural change that'll take many, many years to achieve.
Yeah, well, many, many years. But is that a way of saying never?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Hey, Yassel, thank you so much for your good call.
Can I say one more
thing? Sure, of course. Go ahead.
My daughter is black, and she just recently got her driver's license. And she's led a rather sheltered life here in Coleraine. But I am scared to death of her driving while black in other communities. So,
David?
I take your point. And I know of black police officers of very senior rank who talk about having the talk, especially with their young sons.
Well, the president did.
Exactly right. In other words, this what you fear is a generalized fear. And somehow we have to turn that around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you make good points, Yassel. Thank you so much for calling.
Okay, thank you,
right,
Alan.
Right. 1-800-348-2551. Now you got a real good chance to get in right now. 1-800-348-2551. I invite you, I ask you, I implore you to share your thoughts with us. Let's go back to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
Hi, this is Merle, and I'm calling about... I'm so mad I can't take it anymore.
Yeah,
training.
About what?
A training of police officers.
Right.
In other words, I have an image of a drill instructor getting right in front of a recruit and just yelling his head off, and that recruit is to stand there and take it. I think that this situation that's been going on in the United States over the last several years with the use of video cams has been going on for years, but it's now being recorded.
So what's your point?
My point is that the police need to be trained to be civil at all times, under all circumstances. In other words, the situation where that woman in Texas got killed because he arrested her for not putting out a cigarette was because he wasn't trained enough to be able to alleviate a simple traffic violation.
Okay, so in we bring the expert. David, you go.
In other words,
No. Hey, Merle, my show. Yes. I'm asking the expert now what his reaction to what you said is.
Actually, training in the past 20 years or so has changed a good deal. It used to be very martial, like the Marines, and I think that was a mistake. And since then, the police are treating themselves and their own trainees with much greater respect than they used to. So I think you should be somewhat hopeful in the direction that police training has gone. Now, your point, should they treat everybody with respect? Absolutely. And when they should come, and when they do make a stop, police are now instructed, tell them why you have stopped them, rather than simply proceeding to enforcement of some sort.
Well, every time I've ever been stopped, which isn't that much in life, the police officer always says to me, "Do you know why I stopped you?"
Yes, true.
And I would say no.
And then he tells you.
And then he tells you. But I think that Merle. Wait one second, Merle. I think Merle's question is extremely interesting in that. Obviously, we have a lot of police departments in this country, and the ethics and the training differ widely from police department to police department, right?
Yes, absolutely. Alan, it's a national disgrace, if I may say so. There's 17,000 police forces in the United States. The average size of an American police force is about 40, which means that over half are less than 40. So you've got these tiny police departments, you've got huge police departments, and they vary enormously in their managerial skill, in their discipline, in their training. We are very uneven in the United States.
But so there is no training for a national police officer.
Well, what do you mean a national police officer? You mean is there a national
test?
No, if
you were a police officer in Saratoga and you wanted to be a police officer in Omaha, I would assume you'd have the same training.
No, you would assume wrong. You would assume wrong. And the other point here is, it's interesting, Merle, is that some departments are civil service departments, which means it's hard to fire. In other words, you really have to get the goods, and you have to get people to testify, which they don't want to do, against their own police departments, and you can't get marginal cops out of there. They have to do something really bad.
But don't you think that on a national level that all police officers should be trained to be able to handle a bad situation?
Yes, of course.
On a national level.
Now, of course, but the question comes in.
Can
the federal government step in that way? If they tried to do so, there would be a kickback from the states and the counties and all of those to say this is nationalization of the police, and that's a no-no in the United States.
Yeah. Hey, Merle, thank you very much for calling. Okay, let's go to, let's hear, Rich in Wappingers. Okay, Rich, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to make really quickly ask, it seems like, and maybe it's just the news coverage, so there's a greater perception of this is what's happening, but it seems like in a time when there are more non-lethal options than ever, from tasers to pepper spray to even a billy club.
Hey, Rich, we can hardly hear you, so ask the question straight out. What's the question? We have all of these options, tasers, billy clubs. What's the question?
Why does it seem that the police so often resort to their gun as opposed to a non-lethal option? Is it really happening as much as we think it is? Because it does seem that we're hearing about it an awful lot. And, is there
okay,
a...
Okay, good question. Good question. Let's go to David. David.
We're hearing about it an awful lot, and we're going to hear a lot more about it because of everything being videotaped. We don't really know how often this occurs, where there's an overreaction, and especially the one that results in a death. It's a huge judgment. Think about the police officer for a moment who goes out into a situation, and he encounters a situation that is unpredictable. And he has to make a judgment about the amount of force that he's going to use in that circumstance. This is a terrible position to be in, and I will tell you frankly, I am very reluctant when I make a statement like this or I appear before in the press, making a judgment without knowing all the facts of the case. We ask police officers to use force appropriately. How often does that occur? I will say this. There are about 750,000 police officers in the United States. In a course of a day, they talk to 100,000 people, stop 100,000 people in the United States. Most of those encounters work out very well indeed. We're lucky in what we get normally. Does this mean that police officers are always making the appropriate choice? Not at all.
Yeah, but David, there's still the issue of white and black.
Yes.
So there may be all of those stops.
Yep.
But the question is when somebody is of color and they are driving a car or they're walking on the street where some cop thinks maybe they shouldn't be.
Yes, they're not in the right place.
They
yes.
might be in the right place. Those are not the same as if Alan Chartok is being stopped in a
car.
That
is correct. You know, there's no question that there is what I would call a kind of systematic suspicion for people who are of color. We know this. And indeed, people even in that community will say to themselves that when they see a hoodie person coming at them at night, they cross the street. Jesse Jackson is supposed to have said that. So what must happen is that police must be trained that color is not a complete determinant of how you treat that person. But you treat them with respect because they're a person, and then you inquire about whether something more is needed.
Janet in Columbia City. Janet, you're on. Columbia County, I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Hi, this is Janet, and I'm driving in my car, but I want to address, Alan, your point, that I am a black female, and I was coming from a trip south. We dropped my in-laws off in Manhattan. We were headed back to Columbia County.
Yep.
Because I was in a Land Cruiser, I was waiting for my husband and son to come downstairs, and I was approached. One cop was on the side, the driver's side, with his gun drawn, and another one was at my window on the passenger side, on the driver's side. One was on the passenger. So I'm like, what's going on? I'm just waiting for my husband. I was questioned as to why I was there. I was told that there was some suspicion that a car, a silver-colored car, and I was in a big SUV, not a sedan. It wasn't silver, nowhere near silver. But I was questioned like I'd done something. And then I said to the officer, I said, so why are you stopping me? This is not a silver car. It's not even a sedan. So I'm waiting for my husband and son. What is going on here? What's wrong with this picture?
Where was it? Where was it, Janet?
This was in Upper Manhattan in the Dyckman area.
Uh-huh. Got it.
And we just come back from a family reunion. And we dropped, as I said, my in-laws off in Manhattan. My husband and son went upstairs to...
We got it. Okay,
I was told at that time Giuliani was the mayor, and I was told by this officer that the he had given the police officers carte blanche.
Well,
he didn't
that's
say
right.
Work.
Yeah, no, yeah. What we call Giuliani time. Okay, David, you're on.
Yeah.
Let's let David speak.
What she says is absolutely true, and it happens too much.
Yeah.
Many of my students tell exactly the same stories.
Yeah. Hey, Janet, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. All right. On the email, quote from Joe, I feel all officers ought to be subject to random drug testing. Truck drivers, construction workers, pilots, and others are so compelled, and they do not carry deadly force. What say you, David?
I'm in favor of that. Yes, indeed.
So am I. Okay. And Joyce says, my driver's side mirror was knocked off by a speeding car. Didn't stop. Turned out it was an unmarked police car. Found this out when I reported a hit and run. They told me I hit the police car and that I must have been a distracted driver or I'm too old to drive. They didn't pay for the damage to my car and the two-hour interrogation was awful. It wasn't posted on the police blotter. And that's the short version of the story. David?
What do you want me to say?
Okay. I want you to say nothing. All right. Scott says, if I did what that Ferguson kid did, I would expect to be shot too. In most of the cases in the news, the bad guy or victim, parenthesis, depends on which side you are on or did not comply with the officers. They resisted or were mouthy. The moral of these stories is to follow instructions, be polite, don't resist, don't be a dirtbag, teach your kid to act right before there is an incident. I don't like this letter, by the way.
No, that's a problem because people who are stopped by the police have rights too.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. So if your name is Bill or Eric or Jamie or Willie, stay right where you are.
Support comes from the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. Old Castle Theater Group, downtown Bennington, Vermont, presenting Cabaret the Musical, the story of pre-World War II Berlin nightlife at the Kit Kat Club through August 2nd. OldCastleTheater.org for tickets. Saratoga Saddlery, Saratoga Springs, New York, an equestrian lifestyle boutique featuring cowboy boots by Lucchese and Ariat for women, men, and kids. On Facebook and SaratogaSaddlery.com. Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities. Open 7 days a week, yeoldwarwickbookshop.com. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost 3 decades. ShannonRose.com. And Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors. Serving the Northeast since 2001, StoneSoupConcrete.com and on Facebook.
And we're back. Thank you, Kiba. And we have a lot of people to get in here on the last third, so we'll take short questions and we'll give you short answers, okay? Here we go. Bill from Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Bill, you're on.
When I was younger, the police department or public safety used to like to recruit police officers from the military, primarily the Marine Corps or Army soldiers. This may explain their training and their aggressiveness.
Well,
and that's all I have to say.
Okay, well, that's good. David, do you want to respond?
But the recruiting from the military has declined. It's not what it used to be. So we have fewer of those people, in fact, who have only had military training as opposed to police.
But the thing about military training is you learn how to take orders, too, and to follow instructions.
You also have to take orders. That's right. But you do not have, you're not trained to have interaction with the people that you're dealing with. Indeed, you're trained to shoot them.
Interesting. Thank you, Bill. Let's go to Eric in Ellenville. Okay, Eric in Ellenville, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you very much.
Sure.
I have a question for the professor. With some of the incidents that have been in the public eye for the past years or so, as people mentioned, like Ferguson and stuff like that, one of the things that kept coming up was, and some of the people alluded to that I called them before, was that the police officers weren't coming from the community. They were not, whether the demographics of the community did not fit the police department's demographics of the personnel, and they felt that that was a problem. And the question that I had as far as what is causing that, if the police departments are trying to recruit from the community, say, for example, like in Ferguson or in New York or anything else, so they're trying to do that, but they are not getting the numbers that they're looking for of people from those communities to join the police department. What's the disconnect?
Okay, you got a question, we got an answer. Go ahead, David.
If I knew the answer to that, I'd win the Nobel Prize, because all police forces, especially if they have a large proportion of African-Americans or Latinos, are having trouble recruiting from those communities. After all, the communities are alienated to some extent, and if a person joins, they are apt to be looked at and critically by their own friends. So this is a besetting problem. Now, how do you turn it around? Because it is absolutely essential that you do so. And let me just say one thing. One way around this that I have seen in two or three police departments is when officers are in training, they have to spend weekends and sometimes a longer period working in the communities that they're likely to have to police.
Should they have to live there, though?
Not live there, but at least spend some time there.
So why not live there?
Well, because in many cases, those are communities people don't want to live in, regardless of your color, because there tends to be an association between color and poverty in the United States. And so what happens, and this happens in many large police departments, police officers, white, let's say, will pretend that they live within the community, but in fact they live some other place.
Yeah, yeah. Eric, it is, as David indicates, a very complicated problem. But to me, it makes an awful lot of sense to say you should live in the community where you are patrolling.
I understand that, and what it's saying, what the professor said, and this is where the stuff between the community boards and stuff like that, it almost seems like a catch-22. Just as he said, the community is looking to have more from the community be part of the police force. But when those members of the community become part of the police force, they get alienated by the community.
Quite right.
Eric, thanks for the call. Well, let's go to Jamie in Ellenville. That's two Ellenvilles in a row. People are really listening.
Hey, amazing. Nobody knew there were many people here.
Yeah.
Putting aside the fact that, you know, like police work has to be redefined as a team approach with social workers and mental health workers and all that, do you believe that the single police officer in a car in Texas was a contributing factor to those types of incidents? Like, is a two police officer car better for purpose of even just patrolling?
Okay, good question.
Good
question. Let's get an answer.
That's a very good question, and it depends upon the area. I mean, what's happening now is that at night, certainly in major cities, you have two in a car. But you don't always need two people in a car. And in fact, there is some research that is exactly opposite to what you say. And that is that when you get a bunch of police officers responding to a call, they act up for one another. In other words, they want to display their ability to be a police officer, to be in control, to be a man.
Or they even cover for one another.
And they cover for one another. And so there is research that shows that the more police officers that show up, the greater the chance.
Well, that
of
certainly
problems.
Was the case in Eric Garner and Staten Island.
Indeed.
Everybody's standing
Indeed.
Around. Hey, Eric, thank you very much. Jamie, I mean. Let's go to Willie in Schenectady. Willie, you're on.
Yes, I don't know all about the police work. From what I learned on movies and TV, I see that there's a battery of training where an officer actually makes the decision whether to shoot or not. But there's never the decision made where to shoot, so much so that a universal practice for a weapons qualification is to shoot at the torso.
Sure.
One time there was a woman in Washington, D.C. who had gone awry, and she was driving her car around recklessly, but she had a kid in her back seat.
Yeah, I remember that.
There were five policemen surrounding her car, all pointing at her torso, and no one thought to shoot the tire out. And for all the cases where they shoot guys who have a knife in their hand with a stick in their hand, and so it just seems to me that an easier alternative would be to shoot him in the leg. Is there something wrong with shooting a guy in the leg versus killing him?
It's exceedingly difficult to do that. I mean, all police officers are taught that if they use a gun, it must be because their life or the life of somebody else is in danger. It's a serious situation. And when you shoot, then in that case, you should be effective, and that means killing the person. It is very difficult to use a handgun, even when you're close to them, in order to wound and just hurt in that fashion. In fact, you see this on television all the time, and it's just misinformation.
Willie, you want to come back?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to shoot a tire out.
as opposed to have five people pointing at a
woman.
Well,
I understand the tire issue.
Yeah, me too.
I understand the tire issue. You're right about that. But
I understand also that when a guy is 20 feet away holding a knife, it's easier to even shoot 20 times to try and hit him in the leg as opposed to shooting him one time in the torso.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Willie, thanks for a good call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Sue in Valencia. By the way, folks, we got some real good open phones now, number 1 and 2 and 3. So let's go to Sue in Valencia. Sue, you're on.
Hi, Alan. I guess one of the callers had mentioned the National Police Force or test of some sort, and that really got me thinking about why isn't that on the table? Doctors need to, nurses have to, dental hygienists have to. There's a standardized test that makes sure everyone has at least the basics, and then the communities could build on that.
Sue, I don't think you're right. I don't think that, you know, because I know a lot of physicians who are certified in one state but who aren't certified in another state. They don't take a national test, you know, for
but
that.
But there is a core, Alan. There is a core that guarantees that you have the foundation, even though from there it can get specified, which would be what each community could add to that. No. But that could then include some of that interpersonal stuff besides the police force stuff.
Police are tested in a variety of dimensions, but these tests are state-based tests. They are not a national test at the moment. They simply aren't.
Hey, Sue, thanks for the good call. Appreciate it very much. All right. So now we're going to go to Guillermo in Sunderland, Massachusetts. Welcome back, Guillermo.
Hi. Yes, my name is Guillermo.
I'm
born in South America, in Colombia. And I have also dealt with police issues, not only in this country, but in other countries. So there's a couple of points that I want to make. One, you keep discussing training for police, and I think that until we turn the conversation on terms of hiring police and what are the prerequisites to be a police in a particular area of the country.
So what do you got in mind? So what do you got in mind? What would you like to see as a prerequisite?
Well, a prerequisite, and you were touching about it, people that need to be in the community, that are part of the community police themselves. And also that police need to have life experience, not training, but life experiences, either because they have somebody that are part of their family that is of a different race, they are part of integrated into a community that is a mixed race community, that they have a personal investment, and they have a first-hand information about what happens when people lose it. Because police, at this point, they're losing it, and they're losing it with women, they're losing it with teenagers. They're losing the ability to be present, the ability to be conscious.
Okay, now let's go to the professor because we are running out of time, professor.
I think that's exactly right. I'd like to be able to accomplish that some way. You can put the point maybe this way, and that is that empathy with the people you police is absolutely essential as the core of discipline and correct behavior.
Mm. Yes. So that when you go for a domestic dispute, for example, you have some psychological preparation or you know
indeed, and
you care about the folks who
dealing with people with mental problems.
Well, Guillermo, thank you so much for calling. We'll go to Bobby in Saratoga Springs. Bobby, you're on.
Hi, I have a quick question. Do police officers need to have probable cause to pull you over when you're driving a vehicle? Because I've been pulled over a couple of times and what I would consider harassed and then just let on my way.
I don't know what you quite mean by probable cause. I mean, it's probable cause to do certain things. But if a person sees a person who's driving a car driving contrary to the rules, then that's sufficient to stop them.
Which also means swerving or could mean anything
exactly.
you have.
Okay, well, in my case, I was not doing anything wrong, and they pulled me over and asked me what I was doing in the neighborhood. And another time they asked me whose car I was driving. even though it was my own car without asking.
I once had that. I was driving a car. It was years and years ago on the way to Harper College up in Binghamton, and I had a Hunter College sticker on the back, which I was going. That's where I graduated from. And the cop stopped me, and he said, "Who'd you get the car from?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Hunter is a school for girls." And I'll never forget it because we had a passenger in the car who then put his head out of the window and said something really, really rude to the cop, who then told me to follow him to the station. And I had to really talk my way out of that. You make a good point. Thanks a lot. Okay, let's go to Malcolm in Amherst. Malcolm, real quick, go ahead.
Hi, great show. I just wanted to refute for a moment a comment that the guest made. In terms of the cops being trained, I saw a response, interestingly enough, I'm pretty sure it was on Fox News, which is strange, but a response by a military, someone from the military, somewhat high up, who was suggesting that what he saw in the pictures from Ferguson having to do with the cops all standing there. This is as the protests began, of course, with them standing there, and in terms of their actions and the way they held their weapons even, analyzing that just from a military perspective, he said this was nothing but confrontational and escalatory, and that, you know, soldiers are trained better at this point.
Malcolm, we're running out of time. Yep. David, you want to answer this?
Not really.
Okay, he doesn't want to answer this. Okay.
Thank you.
We have a load of emails. I want to get to some of them real quickly. One says, I was told by a New York State trooper he had been instructed by his superiors to hold cars with a black person and a white person in suspicion and to stop and question. I was appalled. Has your guest heard of this?
That would be appalling.
Yes. Good afternoon. FBI investigation to law enforcement in Ferguson, Missouri revealed that discriminatory policing had been authorized and practiced from high levels of law enforcement down to everyday cop on the beat. What can people do in the general public when this is what we're up against? I think there you talk about community action.
Indeed, throw them out.
Yeah, right. Okay. Why can't citizens insist that whatever questioning is required to take place in view of their own dash cams? Interesting point. The first videos, first few minutes, had Officer Encina, 1 year on the job, giving just a warning to a female driver and a student at A&M in a red car. His tone and questions came across as flirting. Needless to say, Ms. Bland was too tense for that. If it was a tactic he'd even indulge with her, he saw her as irritation, nervousness, and proceeded to push her buttons to get a rise out of her. And boy, he did. We are almost out of time. I got to go real quick. Hi, Alan. Just to refute a comment by your guest, immediately after Ferguson, military personnel made appearances on TV news disputing the police tactics as clearly doomed and to escalate the situation, and how soldiers are today trained otherwise. I'm not sure about that.
In fact, the interesting part of it is that the military, especially when we were in Afghanistan and Iraq, were asking how they also serve as police officers, because they recognized that their military training was not sufficient in order to establish good relations and respectful relations with those particular communities.
Okay. Hello. Police need to be better, but I think we are making policing an impossible task. Police cannot assume the condition is safe and need to be ready for a life-threatening situation. So when a citizen doesn't cooperate, it makes the police feel like the situation is not under control. Issues quickly arise when citizens do not fully cooperate. The training may have to emphasize the small subset of people. And I wish I could read it all, but I cannot. But we get the point. Let's go to very quickly to Abigail in Kingston. Abigail, you're on.
Oh, thank you, Alan. This program is one of the most important programs that you have ever done, because we are in a very precarious position in terms of this country.
We are. Abigail, I wish I could give you more time, but I cannot. Thank you very much. Phil, okay, Phil, you're on.
Hello.
Hello. Very quickly, Phil, one sentence.
Yes, the problem is the politicians, not the police. The police get their power from the politicians. The politicians create corrupt laws, send the police out to enforce their corrupt laws, and corrupt the police in the process.
Well, I got to tell you, Phil, I've seen something different. I've seen times when the politicians who are supposed to be in charge of the police can't rein them in. I've actually seen that.
I know. Hey, there's plenty of bad actors in the police department. I am definitely not a fan of the police department. But
I'm not saying all police are bad.
I want to arrest somebody for weed.
Okay.
The politicians say weed is illegal. even though it's unconstitutional.
Okay. Thank you, Phil. All right. We are just about out of time. In fact, we are out of time. And I know that somewhere in this pile of papers is what I have to read, but not where it is or should be, if you know what I mean. Okay, wait. Here we go. We're about to end it. Thank you all for calling in. It was great of you. And here we go. Support for Vox Pop comes from Fulton County Tourism in the Southern Adirondack Park, fishing on their 44 lakes, camping, hiking, biking, boating, and summer events. 44 lakes, 44 choices, 44lakes.com, and Rogers Book Barn, Hillsdale, New York, a bookstore on a country road with 30,000 used books and classical CDs, open 11 to 5, Thursday to Monday, RogersBookBarn.com, and Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York, custom exhibits, interactive media displays, and commercial casework for corporate interiors, museum installations, and trade shows, EmpireExhibits.com, and SPAC, hosting the Philadelphia Orchestra with 12 performances featuring modern to classic with musicians from around the world, August 5th to 22nd, SPAC.org for tickets. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, the conversation continues online. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Paulette Ryder. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update, and I want to thank our wonderful engineering department for getting it all straight. Thank you very much. Bye now.